Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Todd Longstaff Gowan. He is a landscape architect, gardens advisor to Historic Royal Palace, and editor of the London Gardener. And we're talking about his book, English Garden Eccentrics. 300 years of extraordinary groves, burrowings, mountains, and menageries. Todd, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this marvelous book.
Great. Lovely to meet you.
Now, this is really a collection of biographies of eccentric people who were virtually defined by what they built. And this brings up your point that gardens are themselves a form of autobiography.
Absolutely. And I think it's, I don't think they've been looked at that way very often, but I think that it's absolutely essential in trying to come to grips with some of these people, some of whom one had to read about, around in a great way, because their gardens are largely gone, the ones I've focused on, which makes them more interesting because there's only fragments left. So it's really important that one can reconstruct their lives by using what they created. And they really felt, I think, that they put so much energy into these places that they really were a reflection of their soul.
Is that true for all gardens, even like for the regular person? Gardens are really a personal expression of who the person is.
I think it's true, but I think that in this, in the cases that I've alighted on, I believe it's to a level that is not often seen in gardening. Yes, I think that it's absolutely true that we do, you know, they are a reflection of our intentions and our aims and our loves and likes and things. But these people were doing it to a level that is very uncommon. So, yes, it's an exaggerated form of that.
Because these gardens are so idiosyncratic and personal, it seems like for many of them, as soon as the person died, the garden may have continued in a form. But as you talk about, gardens lack finitude, and each one is a work in progress, that I felt like the gardens really died when the person died.
No, I think you're right. I mean, as someone who spent his life, well, I've spent a lot of my life conserving historic gardens, I do feel that, like Charles Isham, who responded in sort of, he built this incredible garden at Lamport Hall in Northamptonshire, full of fairy miners and weird little collections of garden gnomes and crystal caves and things. And but he was very much of the opinion, he said, when he was contemplating the fate of his very singular gardens, after his death, he said, so soon as the soul leaves the visible constructor, so soon will the soul depart from that structure. And I believe that it's so true that without the original person at the helm or driving the garden, it loses its way. And of course, it's still interesting, but it's not the same, because every time you make a change, it's as a curator rather than as the originator or the, you know, the divining spirit. So,
right. When when you're looking after these gardens post the person, you're really just maintaining it at a certain point in time, correct?
You are, but in a way, one always makes additions to gardens. And I would say that as I've been the gardens advisor of the Historic Royal Palaces, which we have a clutch of six royal palaces in Britain. And the aim there is that to keep as many layers as possible. So we don't, in England anyways, the notion of conservation is to conserve what we feel is of interest for all periods, so that it's not just a single statement. And I think that many of these gardens that we're looking at, I look at within the book, some of them, as I'd say, some of them were constructed from new, but some were already building on the shoulders of an earlier gardener, so that they added a layer to the garden. And I think it's this comprehension that all layers are important to reading a landscape is quite important.
You described that there's a close relationship between collecting eccentric gardens. And I think this book really brings that out. Can you sort of elaborate on that idea?
Yes, because almost all the people I looked at were collectors. And they seek to form, as it were, groups of these things. And it makes them, their gardens, they rise above dull normality by, as it were, in absolute love of forming collections or groups of things. And I think that that really is important, whether it's groups of trees or ornaments or sculpture or mountains, caves, grottos. I mean, anything they were doing, they were quite obsessive in their interest. So I think that it's absolutely right. I have a collector's spirit myself, and I have a similar kind of obsession when it comes to these sort of things. It really is this idea of trying to make sense of the world in a way. And I think what is so interesting about these people, I'd say, as an aside, and it comes to this notion of collecting, is that they're trying to create these sort of very distinctive spaces, and they're not so much to escape from the world of mundane experience, but to make sense of it and to enrich it and to engage on it in their own terms. And collecting is a way of doing that, because it's a way of kind of comprehending the world, and it's bringing these down to the microcosm of the garden that makes the garden so fascinating.
You want to make it clear to readers that this is not a meditation on quote-unquote Englishness.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
and that's really fair, because we have some great examples of eccentric gardens here, and I think I'm sure all over the world.
Absolutely. I think that it's too large a subject to expand upon, but I suppose eccentricity has been seen for a very long time as part of this character. And I was building on the work of this wonderful writer whom I've always admired since I was a teenager, called Edith Sitwell. And she was writing about English eccentrics, and I was captivated by her ornamental hermits who lived in grottos and supplied wonderful decorative conversation to passers-by. And sort of this notion of these sort of freaks who inhabited the gardens and what they were doing. And I suppose the garden was the thing to me that struck me as something that's peculiarly English. I mean, lots of people love gardens, but the English have an absolute passion for gardening. And it's the universal hobby. So in a way, it's kind of although I'm saying it has nothing to do with just being English, it's a peculiar characteristic of people of this little island that we are pretty obsessed with our gardens.
You talk about an overlap between the eccentric and the idea of the picturesque. And yes. I want you to elaborate on that, because that was a fascinating idea.
Well, I think that it's a notion that's just so important in terms of describing how one perceives the landscape. And I think that all of these things are really important in terms of borrowing from the past and trying to put some sort of larger pictorial sort of qualities into the landscape. And I think this notion, again, it goes back to collecting and putting things in this proper sort of order, but in a very personalized way. And it has to do with creating a series of images as well. And I think that it's very much at the forefront, as it were, of all of these creators, is that they have a very strongly image-led ideas of how these gardens ought to be made.
You describe eccentricity as situated somewhere between madness and dull normality.
Yes.
It's a sliding scale.
It's a sliding scale. But I sort of say also it's kind of these people who are making the spaces that are sort of aloof from the everyday reality. And I sort of say it's kind of also between this, it's a very interstitial quality, but I like this idea of sort of incipient lunacy, because from the outside, these people appear to be quite curious and sort of out of the ordinary. And one must remember, of course, that until the early 20th century, being called an eccentric was not a nice thing. I mean, it really was a slander, because eccentrics were considered to be not as we define them, you know, how now people say, I'm eccentric, aren't I wonderful? These are people who were really not, as it were, seen as desirables. They were sort of slightly off the margins of society by their curious behavior. And it's really a very modern thing that we now consider eccentricity a very desirable trait, you know, in a very creative way. And in fact, that's why I stopped my book the people I was interested in around 1930, because after that, it ceases to have this kind of stigma. It becomes much more desirable.
Sort of self-conscious?
It is becomes very self-conscious. And I think also I didn't want anyone living coming up and saying, I'm eccentric, how come I'm not in your book?
Oh, God. Oh, God.
I do. There are a few people who might have said that.
Well, this brings up an interesting point. This is a short list. I'm sure the list of eccentric gardens and gardeners would be much longer. Am I right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely right. And one is limited by available resources. I mean, what survives? And I was, as an historian who's really interested in things from the 17th century up to the early 20th century, so that's my principal interest period, I would say that I was focusing on that timeline. But, you know, again, lots of the papers and documentation doesn't survive. So one's limited by that. And I'd say also that there is, you know, I suspect there are many more eccentrics who didn't have money but
that's
we
right.
don't know about
that's
them
right.
because you know, their papers don't survive. So I tried to make it as representational as possible, and I was quite strict about choosing people who were doing rather extraordinary things and having exceptional gardens. There were some amazing gardens, but I just thought they're not odd enough, or some people who were very eccentric who just didn't make terribly interesting gardens. So I really thought they weren't really viable candidates for my study.
The exception to that is the last garden talked about in your book.
Yes.
And
yes.
What a strange story, because I would have expected the wildest garden from
exactly.
the Panacea Society.
I know.
And it's exactly the opposite.
It's exactly the opposite, and that's the thing that makes us so incredibly eccentric, because here is it's about this woman called Mabel Baltrop Tavia, and she's a fanatical millenarian in the late 19th, early 20th century, who sets about creating the Garden of Eden, only 8 miles from my house in Bedfordshire. And she goes about setting up. She establishes that this is the center of the world, the beginnings, the origins of everything. And but yet she creates the garden, which is the most dreary expanse of lawn and plants you've ever seen.
And there's photographs by this time, so you can actually see the gardens as they were.
Yes, exactly. It still survives. I mean, it's been repaired, as it were, to look even more like it did before. But what makes her so eccentric to me is that here is a woman who is so outre and so bizarre in all her ideas and has so many potential sources to draw from, and all she can think of is using something she's terribly familiar with and comfortable with, which is the English Edwardian garden, which is in itself, I mean, we're not talking about Gertrude Jekyll and these great floral creations. We're talking about the most boring suburban garden in England you might see in the early 20th century. And I just think that's so extraordinary because it's such a bizarre sort of construct. And it's fantastic. And I think also it's very nice to end on the Garden of Eden. And you have lots of religious eccentrics in America. In fact, I think when I was writing about it, I found that there were many more there than there were here. How many gardeners? I have no idea.
Yeah, don't even start. Don't start there. Don't start there.
The thing I
loved about the Panacea Society is they actually thought the real Eden was right there, right, in Bedford.
Absolutely. It was.
Wow. So you're really close to the source.
I am source. And in fact, what's very nice about it, which makes me sleep well every night, is that she said she was determined that Satan was after her and she couldn't leave her house. She couldn't walk more than 77 steps without being accosted by Satan. So she starts creating this thing called the Royal Domain. And in the end, it ends up being 12-mile sort of circumference or radius, pardon me, around Bedford, which is a city sort of south Midlands of England. And I happily fit within that, and she buried these little bits of cloth, which she'd breathed upon to protect this sort of place. So it means the devil can't enter there. So it's we're very, very safe here. But it was, as it were, her expanding dominion of the Garden of Jerusalem across the centre of England. We've had, of course, we've had for years and years people saying that England is Jerusalem, but it's the first time I've seen anyone saying that Bedford is the center of the world.
Now, one of their many activities, and I'm asking you this as a matter of pronunciation, was dancing around the sacred tree.
Yes, the Yggdrasil.
Okay, and that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, exactly. This is the tree of life, which comes from Norse mythology. And it's usually a weeping ash tree. And there was one in the garden there. And so, again, it's this very English thing where she borrowed. Her Christianity was very diverse, we say. She borrowed from lots of sources. So this is from Norse mythology, and they regularly, her and her community of the Holy Spirit, got together and they danced around this tree. And this was all in anticipation of the arrival, the second coming. But it was partly, again, how the garden's used. So it's interesting that they appropriate this tree and become the central, central sort of fonds, as it were, of their garden.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Todd Longstaff Gowan. He's a landscape architect, a gardens advisor to Historic Royal Palace, and editor of the London Gardener. And we're talking about his book, which I just found endlessly fascinating and wild. And maybe it really suggested some things to me. English Garden Eccentrics, 300 years of extraordinary groves, burrowings, oh my God, mountains and menageries. And let's talk about rock gardens, because a lot of people may not realize rock gardens were huge, especially in the late 18th and early 19th century.
Exactly. There's an explosion of interest in rock gardens. A lot of it has to do with this idea of crossing the Alps and looking at
Alpine gardens. Well, the Alps was a major inspiration for
Absolutely.
Some of this.
Absolutely. It's a source of inspiration. And so they were taking rocks from the Alps, of course, and bringing them back to England and using them in their gardens. Of course, and Iceland was among the first ones because Sir Joseph Banks was taking stone from Iceland in the late 18th century, bringing it back to Chelsea Physic Garden and creating a rockery. But there's, as you mentioned, in my book, I cite several instances where they're creating this either a dillera around the garden.
Let's talk about Frank Crisp. Let's talk about Frank Crisp.
Frank Crisp, yes, exactly. The inspiration for Walt Disney. It's true. I mean, he visited the gardens, actually, before he actually created his fairy tale garden. So it was an inspiration. So Frank Crisp, he traveled the Alps, seen the mountains, and had this idea of going back. He was a very wealthy man. He was incredibly intelligent, and he decided that he would create this extraordinary recreation of the Alps in his garden. And the Matterhorn in particular. And he went about it in the most extraordinary way, just ordering hundreds of thousands of tons of rock to make this garden, which I must say, unusually for my gardens in my book, still survives. And it is an extraordinary place. And so he makes this great alpine landscape. He also has a series of other compartments, which I don't go into, but it really was a sort of traveling around the world from Japan to China to Renaissance France. But the mountain is, to me, the most extraordinary. But
he's got this perfect, it looks like a perfect replica of the Matterhorn.
It is a perfect replica. It's amazing. And he actually took a piece from the top of the mountain. He was so rich to do this and placed it on the top of his mountain of sand and gravel and gritstone that he created. But my favorite story of this is, having made this amazing mountain, you see the photographs reproduced in places like Country Life, etc. And it's just so, it just looks the piece. But there's this very great Swiss mountaineer who visits the garden more or less when it's mature, and he says that it was to him this most idyllic and perfect recreation of this garden. Then all of a sudden, a sparrow landed on the top of the mountain, and the whole mystery was destroyed, because you realize the sparrow makes the mountain look like a sort of a sugar loaf instead of this giant mountain. But it was, he's so characteristic of these people who were fascinated by the alpine landscape. We don't have that sort of terrifying rocky landscape in Britain, not very often. So we were always fascinated by the Alps. So it becomes a motif that you see in several gardens.
Now, alpine flowers were featured in many of these. And I wanted to ask you, as a person who knows a lot about gardening, to me, those kinds of flowers are so delicate and don't grow well in other locations. Talk to me about that trade in alpine flowers, because that must have been amazing.
It was very extraordinary. You have to realize, too, that in England, we had very specialist nurseries very early on. And they were cultivating any great numbers of plants for different variety of different purposes. And alpines became very popular again in the 19th century, and they were cultivated quite commonly. So you could buy them, and you could replicate the circumstances. We have generally a pretty favorable climate for growing a great range of plants. And we don't have these terribly severe winters, but we do have some snow sometimes. So in fact, they thrived. And the English have been very resourceful in sort of replicating the circumstances in which we cultivate them. So they actually did terribly well. But there's also, we were mixing those. I mean, in England, seldom is anything terribly pure. We borrow from so much that there is, they mixed in also native plants as well. And this sort of gave it a kind of a slightly hybrid feeling. But it did recreate, for the most part, the sensation of the atmosphere of the original source.
Amazing. I want to talk about the garden at Lamport Hall that has a rockery in it. The rockery has these little gnomes, and some of them are on strike.
They are on strike, and nothing changes in this country. We're still striking. it's this fellow who made the garden there, Sir Charles Isham, was pretty unusual, and he had this vision, I suppose. And he was, he was a rabid vegan, non-smoker, non-drinking, tract writing, eccentric. And he lived on his country estate and produced pamphlets and things and published things. But he got this, somehow early on he'd seen, had these visions as it were of these fairy miners and blacksmiths inhabiting little colonies across the country. And he used to travel around Britain spotting them. He'd sometimes say how he'd see sort of the remains of campfires where they'd been doing their work, blacksmithery. But he then decided he would create his own microenvironment, which he did outside his bedroom window, so that he could rise early, look out, even during the night, look out and see these things taking place. He'd also been to Germany, where he'd seen these little gnomes, which we now know as garden gnomes. And he was really the first man to bring them, the first person to bring them to the UK. So he introduced them into his garden, but they're only 6 inches tall. And he made these little crystalline caves with bonsais on top of the mountains. And he professed that at night these figures would come alive and inhabit his grotto. And yes,
well, he was a believer in fairies and elves.
Yes, yeah. So, and in fact, this place still survives, and I'm hoping
we'll repair
it, because you can still see the house is absolutely beautiful and very intact, and you can still see the rockery. The plants are rather overgrown, but it could be, you know, it could be recovered very easily.
Now,
but again, you know, he is the one of all the people who said, really, I don't care if this garden survives me, because it's just, you know, it really doesn't matter. This is my creation, and no one will do it as well as me. And in fact, no one had an interest. No sooner had he died than his heirs were quite keen on just dismantling most of the things. I think only one fragment of a gnome survives.
Oh. What about the little lady from Brussels?
Oh, yes, I know. I think
what an odd thing. There's a photograph of that in your book. That was eerie. That was creepy.
She's a bit creepy, isn't she? Painted sort of real colors. So, again, there's a kind of a theatrical, I mean, it's definitely a theatrical quality in this garden and in almost all these gardens. And it should be said, too, that some of these gardens were, from the very beginning, open to public and some were intensely private. But for the most part, these eccentrics were happy to share their gardens with people who they thought might be interested in them. I don't think they were interested in people who would spoil their fantasies, but they were quite keen that they should, in some ways, just try and share what they had.
We can't possibly talk about most of the people in this book, but one of the people like I wish I knew, Lady Dorothy. Dorothy Neville. She knew Darwin.
Yes, I know. She had this strange relationship with some eminent people of her age.
Yeah.
And because she was very rich, she could cultivate these extraordinary plants that no one could afford. And they came to her because they needed these plants. I mean, he was very keen on orchids and other things upon which she was doing experiments. And he wasn't the only great naturalist botanist and a person who was doing that. But they came to Lady Dorothy in pursuit of these plants. And she would have, you know, instead of five, she'd have 100 or 200 of these orchids. And she would then happily invite them over. She was very keen. She was almost like a groupie, in a way, of these great people. And she cultivated the most enormous number of plants. But she had other sort of interests as well. But she did throw herself entirely into this pursuit. And
she had 17 hothouses.
I think they were slightly mad. Virginia Woolf was quite cruel to her. Saying, you know, she was a toff, as we say, an aristocrat, with, you know, not terribly intelligent, but sort of got somehow bought her way into the society. But she was, I think, a pretty amazing woman in her own. And also, she's one who just all of a sudden gave it up. She decided her husband died, it was getting too expensive, she just sold it up and more or less went to the equivalent of what we would call Bognor-by-Sea, which is a really, you know, not terribly exciting sort of retirement place on the coast, and decided she'd keep a much reduced garden. So it was with great unaffection, as it were. She just abandons what was to her life's work, just to sort of die very quietly with a modest garden.
I love the fact that she was passionate about carnivorous plants. And you quote her in the book as, she found them repugnant to cheese, but not averse to alcohol.
Exactly, because she did try and feed them wine and cheese, which she professed to say that they like. But it seems entirely unlikely to me. But such are the anecdotes. And again, it's hard to say. She wrote a lot of letters and she wrote a lot of books. But yes, she's a ceaselessly endless source of interest. I like her very much.
Her son described her habit of indulging in audacious flights of reckless whimsicality.
Yes, and that's a very nice, polite way of saying she was slightly mad.
There's one of the things that were important were ewes. Topiary is featured a lot in these, but boy, there was trade in ewes.
It's true. It's kind of a national pursuit. I mean, it's one of these things which obviously it goes back to classical antiquity. The Romans had it, possibly before that too. There were periodic trends. It went up and down in favor. So it happened that from the late 18th century, mid-18th century, they start clipping 1,000-year-old yew trees in some of the London churchyards. And then develops another phase of interest. It's in creating huge quantities of topiaries. And some of them, like Lord Petersham, who has mentioned in my book, becomes a topiary fanatic and taking sort of 300-year-old trees and moving them in a special device that he and his gardeners contrived. And they were among the first people in the world to do this, to move these things up to 40 or 50 miles from their source of origin to his gardens to form this great oasis where he would trim them and prune them in these most extraordinary shapes and crowns, other geometrical things. And so large were these trees that it's written up in the local newspapers at the time that in some of his estate villages, when the trees were traveling down the road in the villages in the high streets, that they would shatter the windows of the houses on either side of the street. So I don't think his tenants were awfully amused by his ploys.
We're completely out of time, and obviously we could talk about this book for hours. My guest tonight is Todd Longstaff-Gowan. He's a landscape architect, gardens advisor to Historic Royal Palace, and editor of the London Gardener in his book, English Garden Eccentrics, 300 Years of Extraordinary Groves, Burrowings, Mountains, and Menageries. You got to read it. Todd, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.